how are you actually changing the trajectory of something? Like, if the person wasn't there, would things have come out differently? If the person jumped in on something, did that meaningfully change the trajectory of that particular project? And the answer should be yes. And I think that is a good proxy for, like, as a manager, are you actually leading teams, people, projects, initiatives, and moving the company forward? Or are you just operating the machinery?
Hello and welcome to the Engineering Leadership Podcast, brought to you by ELC, the engineering leadership community.
I'm Jerry Lee, founder of ELC.
And I'm Patrick Gallagher, and we're your hosts. Our show shares the most critical perspectives, habits, and examples of great software engineering leaders to help evolve leadership in the tech industry. In this episode, we cover adaptability in engineering organizations with Cosmin Niculescu, CTO at Brex. And in this conversation, we look at a number of the different ways that adaptability shows up. We're talking about places like career transitions, management strategy, product strategy, organizational structure, the response to macroeconomic trends, and more. And our goal with this conversation is to give you different perspectives and approaches that can help you become more adaptable in your own careers and in your own engineering organizations. And Cos shares with us some incredible stories. Let me introduce you to Cosmin Niculescu. Cos leads engineering at Brex, building financial technology to accelerate entrepreneurs. Prior to Brex, he was at Stripe, leading financial infrastructure teams, building Stripe Terminal, and establishing engineering teams globally. His career started at Microsoft, launching Azure and Office 365. Enjoy our conversation with Cosmin Niculescu. Cos, thanks for joining us on the show. How are you doing this morning?
Thanks so much, Patrick. It's great to be here. I am doing great. It's actually really nice weather in LA, which is where I'm based, after we've had some rain, although I think the rain is coming back in the weekend. So I'm going to try to enjoy some daytime and sunshine.
It's perfect. In the wintertime, I think we've had up in the Pacific Northwest where I'm at right now, maybe one or two days of sunshine over the last couple months. And so a little bit envious, but I hope you really thoroughly enjoy that. The theme that we wanted to explore today and that we had talked about is this idea of adaptability and how it shows up in engineering orgs and also how it shows up in engineering leadership. And so to prime folks listening in a little bit, one of the things that we're going to do is we're going to examine some of the different ways that this has showed up, both for you in building engineering orgs, but also for you in different phases of your leadership journey. And I think the goal is to give folks, you know, a different perspective or different approaches that they can apply in their own careers or in their own engineering orgs. Probably the best place to start is early on in your career and early on in your life. So the transition that I want to talk about first is your transition from Romania to the US. And so I was wondering if you could tell us about that transition and how did that experience set the foundation for your approach to adaptability? How did that sort of set the foundation and seed for everything else that we're going to talk about today?
So for context, I grew up in Romania, in Bucharest. I moved to the US when I was 18, coming in for college. I actually did a stint in high school for a year as an exchange student to kind of get a sense of what life would be in the US. And from there, basically stayed ever since. If I think about why I wanted to live in the US, two main reasons. One was the general lifestyle. Obviously, everybody growing up, especially outside the U.S., gets to see all U.S. movies, seeing the quality of life in the U.S. and how kids in the U.S. grow up and how people actually live day to day. And number two was I knew that I wanted to do computer science. I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do within computer science. And in Romania, I would say at the time, you had three major universities, either math university, an economic institute, or a physics university. And within that, you can do some computers applied to those specific domains. But I wanted to do computer science. I didn't want to do like any of those things hardcore. And then with a little bit of computer science, it was mostly the opposite. So I knew that US is the best place to come and study computer science. And so I applied to a ton of universities. I had to get a scholarship because I couldn't afford to come to the US otherwise. My first night when I got to my dorm, my roommate hadn't arrived yet. I had nothing. I had two suitcases, empty bed. I didn't even have bed sheets. And I actually cried myself to sleep. It was like, what the fuck am I doing? And I realized that like, this is up to me to make it successful. And so the next day, basically woke up, went to Bed Bath & Beyond, got a bunch of bed sheets, started exploring Philadelphia. I went to school at Drexel. That kind of set for me everything in the beginning of you basically control a certain aspect of your life. and you can make the most of that and make the decisions you want. And if anything else is outside of your control, I think a lot of people take their luck that they have for granted, and they just assume they can influence those outcomes. Whereas for me, I kind of learned early on to kind of what can I accept and what can't I control, and just move on.
What a powerful like memory to learn that lesson, because I feel like I've bumped into this idea of like you can control what you can control, but to have that attached to like such an important moment in memory for you, I think is really powerful.
Yeah, I think it's helped me throughout my journey as I've kind of matured as an engineering leader, as an engineer, and been in different situations of what do I stress about versus not. I remember early on at Microsoft when I was an engineer, I would try to understand what executives at companies spend their time on. And it just felt like a very stressful job because like you're responsible for the outcome of a ton of different people, business complexities, et cetera. And a lot of the other leaders that I talked to, I found that what they tend to worry about are the things that they can't control and they're trying to influence. And I think it just helped my sanity to basically be like, okay, I can't control that. And so it is what it is. And then we just move on. And then here's the things that I should spend my time on because I can affect the outcomes. And I think that's also happened in my personal life as well. There's things that I might normally would stress me out, but because of that mindset, I generally am like, okay, I can phase that out. I quite enjoy fires. I enjoy incidents, not necessarily causing them and not the impact that they have, but just solving them. I think you get both some adrenaline rush and some dopamine. And the way I think I'm able to function is those is just like compartmentalized between like, okay, what are the things that we need to focus on and just be able to block out everything else. So I do think that's kind of helped dealing with changes throughout my life and in day-to-day job and personal life as well.
The emergency response mentality, I think, is such a gift for those types of moments, because I know that my stress spikes significantly during those types of moments. And like you have to do a lot to learn that type of like to build yourself like a certain framework or response to address those types of things.
Yeah, and I think it has some downsides as well, in that I'm the kind of person, both in professional and personal life, that doesn't have very high highs or very low lows. The good thing is I can deal with fires and kind of unexpected things very calmly. On the flip side, I'm also, again, I don't go woohoo very much, as you can tell.
I think one other thing, there's going to be a couple, I think, as we talk, a couple different little nuggets of profound wisdom that I think are going to come up here. So one of the things that you mentioned just so offhand was this practice of just trying to understand what executives are spending their time on, like when you first joined Microsoft. To do that at such an early stage in your career really trains your mental model to think differently. Why did you first start to do that, and how have you applied that in different settings?
As I was early in my career progressing, I didn't really know exactly how I wanted my career to go. I love writing code and building stuff, and I wanted to do that for as long as possible and forever. In fact, I had a relatively poor opinion of managers. At Microsoft, there were few managers that were exceptional, and I got very lucky. All the managers that I had at Microsoft were very, very good and helpful for my career, whereas I met a lot of managers who I did not think very highly of. And so in general, I started with the mindset of like, oh, I think managers are useless, and I didn't want to be a manager. And that kind of progressed to like, well, it seems that everybody who's an executive by definition is a manager. And so are they useless or not? Because on one hand, I can think of them and the impact that they're having, how they operate, and I'm very impressed about the outcome. On the other hand, they're managers and they lead organizations, which again, I'm like, what does that really mean when you have exceptional people just building things? So that was probably the trigger of like trying to understand, not whether I want to be one or not, because I wasn't thinking about that at all. Like if you would have asked me 15 years ago when I got out of school, whether I would want to be like an executive at a company or CTO, like I would have said no. I think it came mostly from the sense of curiosity of trying to understand how things work. And I think I've always had that, whether it's how a piece of technology works, how something in the world works, how people work and what they do. And I tend to be pretty fascinated about those questions. And so it started with, hey, execs seem to be really good, but what makes them really good? And what makes someone really senior very good? Because obviously it's disproportionate impact.
You're talking about some of the early insights at Microsoft. And then there was another big inflection point when you transitioned from Microsoft to Stripe. In that transition, what came up for you about adaptability, either as a leader or either with the engineering orgs that you were supporting? How did adaptability manifest in that particular transition?
So I moved from Microsoft to Stripe as an engineer. Stripe didn't really have managers at the time. There was a VP of engineering, and he was basically managing all the teams, and they were rolling out managers, and some of the people were kind of like team leads. I would say number one in terms of activity was company size. So Microsoft, my division alone was thousands of people. Microsoft as a company was over 100,000 people. It's multiple companies in one realistically. And so going to that to, I think at the time Stripe was a 100-person company, was literally orders of magnitude different. Everybody kind of told me, like, you have to get ready for the shock of, like, what it is to not work in a corporate world. And that's actually what I was looking for. When I was leaving Microsoft, I wanted to go to something much, much smaller and try it out just because I did not get that experience. I knew I could always go back to something bigger later in my career. Generally, it's not always the case that you go to something smaller later in your career. The second one was the technology stack. And that was, again, part of the reason why I wanted to do something outside of Microsoft, which was I wanted to get outside the Windows and .NET bubble. I remember interviewing a candidate when I was at Microsoft who'd been in the industry for like 20 plus years. Everything was very Java, JVM, like anything. And part of it felt somewhat sad in that your entire life, you've only basically focused on solving the same problem over and over again and same technology. And in the world, there's so many different things coming up. And I wanted to try that out. And so getting used to an entirely new stack where literally there were all these tools, programming languages, open source technologies that I had never worked with before was something really exciting. I had to get used to it. And the learning curve when you join an environment like Stripe with such exceptional people who all have been working in that space because they are either from universities and universities do a lot of open source or had just been at other startups gave me quite the imposter syndrome, but also quite the learning trajectory there. And then I think the third one is what management meant. I managed briefly at Microsoft and to be honest, hated it. I found it literally the definition of middle management where all you do is just bureaucracy and you don't really get to influence culture. You don't really influence even outcomes that much at that level. At Stripe, as I saw people going into management, kind of the team leads and what they spend on time on, I realized that it's actually very, very different. And you actually get to impact culture quite a lot. You actually deal with foundational problems for the company. That was pretty eye-opening. And I would say it's one of the examples where I went in with like a negative opinion of like, I don't want to manage. I hate it. I think it's kind of useless. To this can be really exciting and powerful and disproportionate leverage again.
What's interesting to me is like this switch from management is useless to identifying some of the core things that you've seen to become really impactful. And so I'm wondering, like, from this experience here, like, because you're talking about like the opportunity to influence culture and influence outcomes, like that is like a big opportunity of a manager to make a big impact or like addressing the foundational problems of the company. Do you have any thoughts on bridging that gap between sort of like this useless analog of a manager to something that becomes more impactful? Or how have you thought about that as you built out different management teams or built out the management structure within your organizations?
I think it goes to thinking about what does success mean as a manager? Because everybody talks about you're supporting people, you're helping them grow in their careers, et cetera. And very much true, like the best managers in the world do that. I think for me, it boils down to two additional things. One is the difference between manager and leader. I think Microsoft at the time had a lot of managers, but not a lot of those managers were leaders. And I think that was the difference at Stripe. Like at Stripe, those managers were leaders. And I tried to emulate the same thing as I started building engineering organizations at Stripe and at Brex. You don't have to be a manager to be a leader, but I think it is really important to be a leader if you are a manager. And I think we kind of lose track of that. The second one is a leadership principle that we have at Brex as well, which is being able to operate at all levels. And this is something that you hear a lot, you know, over time, managers are more hands-off. They spend time on high-level things. They manage to other people. And again, I think there's structural things that, of course, make sense as the organization grows. But I think it's really important to be able to go really deep on different problems and know which problems to go deep in and actually change the trajectory. To me, the litmus test that I have with a lot of managers, if I think about like performance is, again, are your teams happy and productive, which again is baseline. And then the second one is like, how are you actually changing the trajectory of something? Like if the person wasn't there, would things have come out differently? If the person jumped in on something, did that meaningfully change the trajectory of that particular project? And the answer should be yes. And I think that is a good proxy for like, as a manager, are you actually leading teams, people, projects, initiatives, and moving the company forward? Or are you just operating the machinery And there's a balance. You have to do both. It's mostly like what's the skew and the balance between those. And I think you've noticed also in the industry in the last few years, this change from like, hey, companies are starting to have too many managers. And the result is that they're spending too much time on the management system. And we can probably operate more leanly by having fewer managers who are able to actually lead. And I think that's been a good change. We've applied to Brex. There's a lot of startups who are doing that. There's larger companies who have done it as well. I think Facebook and Meta are probably the most common examples.
With sort of like the trajectory or pendulum changing in terms of like the role of managers within companies, like I'm using manager as like a term for like the function, not necessarily like the role. Like I'd say like an ideal good leader or manager within an organization, like what might be the qualities that will become more in demand as like this paradigm of less focus on the management system and more focus on flatter organizations? Like what are some of the qualities that you think are trending to be more valued versus others?
I'd say first and foremost, by doing that, you have to be able to go into details. That is probably the biggest change that you see. And that doesn't mean necessarily that every manager has to spend all their day writing code or every week writing code. I think you should be able to. And I think that is important to kind of be in touch with what's going on the ground. But I think it's literally going into details and helping in the building process. And that involves design, architecture, how we think about the business problem, and go really, really deep. The challenge with that is, one, I think as a manager, you get more rusty on those things as the organization scales. And so you also need to have the right systems in place to know what to jump in. Because otherwise, I forget the exact saying, but someone gave me this advice, which was bad managers basically don't delegate anything and try to do everything. And obviously, that's also not scalable. The first one, when you move from an IC to a manager, an individual contributor to manager, is to know, one, how to delegate, and two, how to pick up things that are left from the team. And so you go through, let's say, your sprint, and everybody takes something, and then you take on whatever is left that you think you have bandwidth for. And I think that's great. And most of the times, like when fires come up, you're able to delegate efficiently. And again, you take the non-glamorous work. That was the advice I was given when I joined Brex, is that you can only do that so much because you have so many other things to deal with. And as a company, if you have growth problems, you have way more problems than you have people to solve them. And so you have to be comfortable letting fires spur, which means you have to know which fires to put out, which fires are too big and you need to deal with them. But more importantly, which fires are small now, but can grow really big versus fires that can stay smaller for a longer period of time. And then you can let those burn. And so I think going back to operating at all levels, it's not just going really deep on particular problems and actually changing the trajectory of those things, but it's also knowing which things to spend your time on and which things to go deep on. And so having the systems, having the intuition, and being able to consume a lot of information really efficiently, I think becomes really, really important. And you have to do that in a way that doesn't necessarily add a lot of overhead for the team. I think big companies are notorious for having like a lot of meetings and updates and write-ups to give visibility upwards to your management chain. But the reality is like that work is purely done to satisfy that need of upper management, but it's not actually meaningful to the business. And so I try to think about how do we do that without creating that overhead? So I can still catch up and read on things that are just outcomes of the work happening versus outcomes designed to give me the information so I can make better decisions. Obviously, you need those occasionally, and we have like review forums for the business. But again, that helps make sure that the whole business is on track, and it helps not just management, but literally all the leaders in the company versus the idea that you're just in meetings reviewing updates all the time. And that was a big part when I was at Microsoft. I felt that there were a lot of meetings with upper management. They were just reviewing things and giving feedback. And then you come back a week later and you address the feedback and they give you another round. And that's basically the job.
Can we deconstruct about like how you approach that at Brex? Like, so this process behind triaging the fires, the priorities, and doing that without overhead. Can you share a little bit more about like what that looks like maybe in a day-to-day or like in a structural way?
So at Brex, we have a ton of transparency internally. Everything is open by default, Slack channels, Google Docs. Obviously, there's sensitive things that get locked down. And we monitor and audit a lot of customer information. So that's not fully open. But how we actually build things and how we make decisions is very transparent in the company. One thing that I've learned to do, and I think leaders in my organization, I think, have done well, is able to consume information from a lot of different channels in an asynchronous fashion. So I think being able to consume information on your own pace and your own time is super valuable. So for example, we ban slides in the company. We don't do slides. Everything is a memo, which obviously Amazon is notorious for pushing it early on. But I think that's really valuable. And the reason why it's really valuable is a lot of times, I'm sure everybody's been in meetings where someone is presenting. And the problem is the presenter controls the pace versus the recipient controlling the pace. And in a meeting, if you don't have a slide and you have a document that is a pre-read, now we can just spend the time on the things that the audience for that meeting wants to spend time on versus like, let's walk through it at the pace of the presenter. And it's also rude to say like, okay, let's just go to the next slide. I already have the information on this slide. And it's also much more dense information in a document than a slide. Slides have a few bullet points. And so naturally, you need someone to voice over and go more in detail, whereas with memos, you can go much, much deeper. And so we have this writing culture at Brex that's helped us scale, especially as we have folks all over the place. We have folks in the US, Canada, Brazil, and it's allowed us to operate without needing a ton of meetings and a ton of coordination in a synchronous fashion. You still need to work together asynchronously, but again, I think the pace really matters. The second thing is architectural reviews, but the output of the things that we review in those are not documents or anything prepared for that meeting. We explicitly said that what we want is just the design docs that everybody has, and teams just have those as a way of collaborating. Actual code that we can look through, like interfaces, schemas, et cetera, things that are harder to change over time. Business logic is easy to change. And so we literally, like as pre-reads for those reviews, simply go through the artifacts created by the team working on that for the purposes of them working through it versus I'm going to come up with a presentation for that. And we've had some times when people, because they get nervous trying to put together content specifically for that, and we tell them like, we really don't need to, like, please don't. We generally just want to be able to go and have a conversation about the things that you guys are building without adding overhead for these things. I think it tends to be initially people aren't fully comfortable with that because again, everybody's so used to creating those kind of review forums. But afterwards, they get really excited about it and you kind of remove that overhead quite substantially. And so I spend a lot of my time just like, I see different documents, I see different things on Slack, I see different emails, and I can skim through them. And then I have some kind of spidey sense, which I guess you build over the years to be like, okay, I need to really pay attention to this versus this generally looks good versus there's something here, but I can't exactly tell what it is. And I need to spend more time going deeper on that.
For those meetings, like, do you define like the type of output that you want to be able to spend time on? Does that happen ahead of time? So like when you're going into that architectural review saying like, we want to walk away with this meeting with this particular output, is that typically happen ahead of time or?
It depends on the meeting. So for example, with the architecture reviews, we tend to have those with basically all the senior engineering leaders in the company, both managers and ICs. And there's pre-reads that basically people send like, here's, again, code, design docs, et cetera, and people generally have questions on those. And they, so they come up with those bullets in it that we share with the people in the meeting. But a lot of times, similar to kind of this podcast, you have a topic and then you go deeper and then you go from that to another topic. We try to keep it more natural, but we try to prepare people for seeing that. And then on business reviews, we do those on a quarterly basis. Similarly, we share feedback from the executive team to each of the organizations, and then we choose some discussion topics that either we or the team wants to talk about. But a lot of the other questions get answered asynchronously because there's no point, like if it's an easy, relatively easy question, you can just answer it in a paragraph and be done with it.
Like the high level things I'm taking from this is don't use these meetings for a review, use them for output, reduce the overhead so that you can move faster. And I think like that is a guiding principle for thinking about that. I love it. Like I'm already thinking about a bunch of meetings I can just restructure instantly.
Yeah. I mean, first ideal is don't have the meeting in the first place. So if you can avoid it altogether, great. Obviously, that's not realistic. And there's also times when I see a lot of things asynchronously, like Slack threads with like 100 plus responses. I'm like, you all should just probably have a 15-minute meeting and you probably would have gotten through this faster. So there's definitely a balance. I don't think extremes are the most useful one. And then yeah, afterwards, it's like for each meeting, is it actually useful? Who are the participants? So that, again, notorious for meetings, especially in the remote world where majority of people are just like waiting or just doing work on their own or browsing the web or something because they're not really needed for that meeting. And I think transparency also helps. I talked about how Brex has that. A lot of the reasons why I find in other companies, people join meetings and want to be in meetings is because that's how they get access to information. And so being transparent, having information and docs available, having the recordings from meetings that people can watch on their own pace, you can 2x it, you can just watch a subset of it, I think removes that need and addresses it pretty efficiently.
I just had an enlightened moment. Oftentimes where I feel frustrated is like if a meeting happens and I'm not a part of it, and I'm more frustrated because I don't have access to the information than I am like being participating in the in the meeting, especially if that has it, if the decision of that meeting impacts me or the things that I'm working on. I totally get it now in terms of like the documentation or like the ability to build the information architecture so that other people can access that in a transparent way. I'm like, oh my God, so many of my needs would be satisfied just by that simple shift.
Exactly. I mean, it's a very natural thing to want to be included, especially when things affect you or might affect you. I've been in meetings where something might affect a team, but not really. Or if it is, it's a very small, like one question that came up that could have easily been answered without being in a 1 hour or half an hour or whatever meeting. So yeah, I think fine tuning that. I think it goes back to the only people who can change that are generally more senior people in a company, managers, because they're the ones who generally organize those things. And how you do it generally both influence majority of the meetings because they're the organizers and also sets the example for others of how to run those. And every few months, we basically do that. We do a calendar audit at Brex. We look through the different meetings. Right now, we're actually thinking about probably by the time this airs, we'll have made changes to, we have a bi-weekly forum for reviewing like generally business metrics. And we're kind of looking through optimizing that because it's got to be 40 plus people in a meeting. And it's just like the antithesis of what we would normally want. So I think it's really important to kind of evaluate those things on a regular basis.
You had mentioned sort of the role of a manager is changing right now. We're in this environment. And I think one of the elements of adaptability that we wanted to talk about is this current one that most people are experiencing, which is this transition from this zero interest rate phenomena to the current macroeconomic environment. And so I was wondering, like, what are you thinking about when it comes to adaptability, given this shift that we're experiencing right now?
Yeah, so I would say most companies that I've seen or most successful companies that I've seen over the last 10-ish years generally were not bounded by dollars they raise. And it was very much growth at all costs. In a lot of cases, there was generally a race of like who can grow fastest and then acquire most of the market. I would say from an engineering perspective, generally bounded by how many people can we hire and how many people we can onboard without lowering the bar. And I think in the last couple of years, you've seen across the board a shift from like, oh, actually think about profitability, think about margins. Are you actually efficient? How do you measure efficiency? And I think that the challenge for a lot of people, myself included for what it's worth, is that unless you've operated for decades in the industry, you just haven't seen that sort of push. And so you don't really know what to do. And I've noticed that with investors, it's easy to say like, everybody all of a sudden overnight should go from like grow at all costs to are you profitable and how do you think about that? But they're not very helpful in helping you through that path. Similarly from founders, they've never operated in that environment either. And so now they have to adjust and obviously executives as well. And so for us at Brex, I think this started over 2 years ago when we started looking a lot at the efficiency metrics for the company for engineering. The pace at which we ship things, how do we actually think about build versus buy? How do we actually think about the benefits of remote and being able to hire in different geos? And obviously there's cost benefits from that as well. I think the theory is very easy, but systemically it's really hard. So for example, at Brex last year, we had a goal as a company that 80% of new hires are going to be outside the US. And we wanted to do that in order to have the mix because for two reasons. One, we have folks in Canada and Brazil, but the balance was very heavily towards the US, and which means those folks start feeling more left out. And number two, especially if I think about Brazil versus the United States, there is a substantial financial difference there as you scale the company. And I think you start thinking a lot more about like, hey, what are the sort of roles that are needed in different geos to make it successful? What are the roles needed to make a company successful? Or do you actually have hard technical problems where someone with really deep expertise in a particular area that accumulated over decades at working at a large, like high growth company, let's say, I don't know, Meta, Microsoft, whatever, or are you just building features that larger companies need and it's just an execution problem? You just have to go through that. You start thinking a lot more through that lens. And I think that that's changed quite a lot. And I see the theory of it much easier than doing it. Like I've talked to other companies who are in the same path, you know, we're a remote company, so we should get the benefits from that. And so 10% of our hires are going to be international. It's like that won't actually move the needle. If your goal is to make more structural changes, you have to be much more aggressive. And I think people are generally scared to make big changes. But I think the companies that have been successful when you see these major shifts tend to make generally pretty substantial changes themselves.
Just a quick follow-up question. So one of the driving questions you asked at the beginning of this, I thought was really interesting, which was like the, what are the roles needed to make the company successful? Or what are the roles needed to make different geos successful? So when you're thinking through like building out and changing the hiring structure or like the hiring strategy for the organization to do this, like were there any particular roles that you felt helped set up for success for a more distributed hiring?
A good example with Brazil, where we started hiring a couple of years ago, was we had a few engineers, but basically no one senior, no managers. And they made it really hard to kind of feel that it's at equal balance with the US, for example. And also in general, like having people who can actually amplify the growth of the organization in that particular market. Like if you think about hiring, if you think about recruiting, events, et cetera. And so last year, one of the things that we had explicit goals around, again, was hiring some leaders, managers, and individual contributors in Brazil to make sure that we have them as well, like we do in the US and like we do in Canada. I think that was a huge structural change because it started leveling the playing field. One thing that was also interesting, a lot of companies, when they take the multi-geo approach, generally have concentrations and teams organized around the geo. So team X is in country Y or city Z. At Brex, we took a different approach, especially because the time zones are all aligned. We basically have teams that are fully distributed. And so a team will have folks in the US, in Canada, in Brazil, different places in the US. It's not like there's an area that's more dense than others, which means everybody kind of has an equidistance from each other. In the beginning, the thinking with Brazil was, I actually had the same original mindset, which was, you know, we'll start off by having some folks remote, but then we'll reorganize them and actually have teams in Brazil so that they work together. And when I met with folks in Brazil, they were very vocal about like, we actually love the fact that teams are all distributed and we all get to work on different parts of the business and we don't have like teams in different geos. And so that actually affected how I think about it and changed my mindset to kind of keep it that way. So now we have teams where like the manager members in Brazil, you have some engineers in the US, Canada. Again, it's truly random if you were to actually look at a random sample.
This is kind of a special time to be in conversation because it's a reflective time in that I know you're beginning a transition away from your time with Brex. And so I was wondering maybe if you could talk about this transition now from Brex to what we'll say is beyond. What makes this transition different? And from your perspective, like what have been some of the elements that you found uncommon to do this the right way? What needs to exist in order to transition in a probably a more uncommon way in the industry?
So for context, I'm going to transition by summertime. So I'm here at Brex until July, and then we'll basically go in an advisory role as I go and build something new. I think there's two things for me that are special in this. One, on a personal level, every move from Microsoft to Stripe, Stripe to Brex, I had a month in between jobs, and I always left something knowing what my next job is going to be. This is the first time where I don't have that very concretely. There's something both exciting about it because it allows me to actually decompress and take a longer period of time off. But at the same time, there's more anxiety in terms of uncertainty that you have to be comfortable with. And this is one of those things going back to the beginning of our chat where there's things that you can control and things that you can't control. No point in worrying about things you can control. But this one I technically can control, but choose not to kind of give myself the space. So it's a little bit interesting psychology. And then the second one is most transitions that I've seen from senior leaders in companies tend to come in the form of you have someone, let's say an executive in a role, they're great for a certain stage. At some point, they're probably not scaling or there's something that's changed or the company's not doing well and they leave. And like there's basically a departure and a replacement search and you hire. And typically the larger companies are the ones that have transition plans and they're able to kind of like hand off. Obviously, Amazon has recently done that with Bezos to Andy in the last few years. But most of the time, you don't have that luxury and you don't have that process. And I found that to be very special at Brex because like the guy I'm handing off engineering to, James Reggio, he's unbelievable. We've worked together at Stripe. I've known him for over a decade. He's been at Brex for 2-3 years now. And he's like unbelievable leader. And so my job now is to transition things in such a way that he's set up for success. And it's very different because to be honest, like if you weren't here and part of my transition plan and thinking about that, I don't know that I would have had the same confidence to say it's a good time for me to kind of hand things off at Brex to someone else. because the risk of bringing someone else external is very, very high. We've seen that both at Brexit and generally at companies, like senior roles are very hard to hire and get right, because the individual doesn't just have to be great, but they also have to be great for the particular company and culture. And so I think that to me is really special. I'm helping more behind the scenes and I'm trying to take a step back. And I've never had to do that either, because again, general transitions are, you know, you have another job, you hand things off and you kind of move on. Like as a manager, maybe you have a month notice instead of two weeks notice. Whereas I have basically like a 5 month transition period. And so, yeah, I feel very fortunate to be able to kind of hand things off to a friend.
I can't think of another example of where this has happened, like in my sphere, like having done the podcast for 4 years, you know, we've got almost 200 episodes and like it has never come up once. The relationship seems so strong between you, the organization, the person transitioning in, like it just is so uncommon to me. And I just think that's incredible. So if you had to leave people with one tip for if you happen to have the privilege to develop a succession plan this way, what would be something that you're really focusing on between now and the next 5 months to help ensure this transition goes really smoothly in the way that you feel really good and proud of?
So number one, I would say to get to this place, I think it's really important to be very transparent. If you're an executive with the founders and kind of being pragmatic about things, I'm very fortunate that Pedro and Enrique have been amazing, supportive, always trying to find the right balance between like, okay, cause, what do you want to get out of this? What's great for the company and how do we make those work really well together? And being able to have that transparent relationship, I think helps quite a lot and doesn't create surprises on either end. For the transition, I would say it feels very long to me. And in general, like you kind of worry between, on one hand, you're kind of a lame duck because I shouldn't make any more decisions. If I'm transitioning things to someone else, they should make the decisions. And so James and I were very explicit that like, there's some backwards looking things that I'm helping with and forwards looking, he should make all decisions and I'm there to provide the context. On the other hand, you still want to be involved and have the context to be able to help that person. But if you're in the meetings, then people look up to you because they're just used to it. And so I've been very explicit about like de-lurking from a lot of the meetings and trying to just keep context in an asynchronous fashion again. And then have James come to me with like, here's how I'm thinking about this. Or if I notice something or hear from others, work with James for those things. Every month, I try to have a plan of like, okay, what's the level of involvement? How am I helping? That should be different than the previous month. Because if every month you're kind of doing the same thing, you're not actually transitioning. You're kind of have a job, which the job is transitioning. Whereas my goal is like, I shouldn't have a job. That is literally the purpose of a transition. And so every month should be different than the previous month and ideally less involvement so that you feel comfortable. And you should be comfortable saying like, hey, maybe in like by the end of next month, I don't have to do anything at all because the company is doing great, James is doing great, and all I need to do is just be a sounding board occasionally. And that's great. You shouldn't let your ego get in your way.
I almost feel like in a lot of ways, this is almost reverse engineering, like somebody also expanding their leadership. Like in some ways, like if you were really truly like growing your impact as a leader, like the thing you're doing should be changing every month or in terms of like the types of work that you're focused on. So like, I almost think like the timeline of this can work in two different directions. I think it's really powerful. Cause, we've got a couple rapid fire questions to close things off if you're ready.
Of course, let's do it.
First question, what are you reading or listening to right now?
Well, I'm listening to you right now, so to be very concrete. Reading, recently finished Outlive, phenomenal book by like how medicine has basically solved problems in a very specific way, but the next stage in life quality is very different. I'm reading 0 to 1 from Peter Thiel because, again, one of the things that I want to do next is probably build my own company. Actually, I had a friend from Microsoft staying with me and he recommended Satya's book, Hit Refresh. So I added that, but I haven't read it yet. And then finally, I tend to read multiple books in parallel. The other one is Generations, which was recommended by some friends in LA that examines patterns to each of the generations, like Gen X, Gen Y, Millennials, Gen Z, et cetera, to kind of extrapolate trends there. Fascinating book on that.
This has been a great conversation because we've got not only just like a guide to like totally deconstruct and reconfigure meetings to be more efficient, but we've also gotten about your entire library. And I think that's really powerful.
I wish that was my entire library. I have 100+ books that I haven't read yet that I've bought on Amazon that I need to. So hopefully I can catch up on that during the next few months.
Next question. What's a tool or methodology that's had a big impact on you?
I know I think in the last couple of months, it's gotten a lot more publicity, but I would say I was a pretty early user of Perplexity.
which for those not familiar, it's basically like ChatGPT, where you can basically ask any questions, but it's designed and optimized for queries like you would in a search engine. So it gives you sources in addition to just like summarizing things. And I found it really, really useful. You have a bunch of different knobs. You can try different models. And I would say my searches now are 50-50 between like a Google search, which is still very useful for like something really quick, like how old is X person, like whatever celeb, since I'm LA, like much faster to do on Google. It's not worth doing all updated to and waiting for a few seconds. But for anything deeper topics, I think it's really useful. And a bunch of different categories, like my recipes. I do a lot of cooking, and now all my recipes just generally are done through Perplexity before it used to be TikTok.
I love it. Last question, Kaz. What's a trend that you're seeing or following that's been interesting or hasn't hit the mainstream yet?
I think there's some interesting trends that are starting in the robotics space. I have a bunch of friends in LA who work on like hard tech, so satellites, robots, factories, efficiency, and machinery. And I think historically that's been avoided more because software is generally easier and faster. And so people tend to gravitate towards that, and investors tend to maximize profits and minimize risk. But I'm starting to see a lot more of that happening now, both due to AI and a lot of automation and the macro kind of politics with China. I think you're starting to see more of that.
A powerful trend to leave us with. Kaz, thank you so much for, I think, a really special moment of reflection and being able to catch you right here in this moment of your life and to go back all the way to your earliest career. And as you now consider what happens next, the lessons that have come up for you and the things that you're reflecting on, I think it's really special to catch you here. So thank you for your time and for sharing stories with us.
Of course. And thanks so much, Patrick. It's amazing and a pleasure as always.
If you enjoyed the episode, make sure that you click subscribe if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, or follow if you're listening on Spotify. And if you love the show, we also have a ton of other ways to stay involved with the engineering leadership community. To stay up to date and learn more about all of our upcoming events, our peer groups, and other programs that are going on, head to sfelc.com. That's sfelc.com. See you next time on the Engineering Leadership Podcast.